Since 1912, L.L. Bean has been helping people get outside together with gear tips and advice for exploring all the possibilities of the outdoors all year long. Here's a quick tip for your next ski, snowboard, snowshoe, or sledding trip. Change into your socks and base layers when you get to the mountain or trailhead, not before. A toasty car ride is a great way to ease into the day, but it might introduce moisture that could make you cold later. Start dry and warm so you'll stay dry and warm. For more tips, easy how-tos, and inspiring stories, visit llbean.com/explore.
Throughout human existence, it certainly hasn't been uncommon for women to play the role of unofficial business partners to their husbands, without the accolades, the respect, or the pay. However, those married to national park rangers faced some unique challenges. Their lives were steeped in isolation, basic amenities were a luxury, and their homes, often primitive at best, were nestled in the heart of America's most remote wildernesses. They not only kept their own household, they served as de facto rangers themselves, performing so many necessary functions that allowed national parks to operate. Yet, despite their significant contributions, they remained unpaid. Their efforts unrecognized by the iconic green and gray uniform of the National Park Service. I'm Jason Epperson, and this is the America's National Parks Podcast. In the early days of national parks, the federal government saw a preference for hiring unmarried men as park rangers, especially in remote locations like Yellowstone, Yosemite, and Sequoia. These parks, previously managed by the military, offered limited housing, mostly former barracks with a scant number of homes for officers and their families. As the National Park Service took the helm in 1916, the existing infrastructure dictated a continuation of this trend, though not without its share of controversies. Tales of rangers smuggling their wives into parks circulated among employees for decades, a testament to the longing for companionship amidst the wilderness. The transition to allowing ranger families within the parks wasn't smooth. The harsh realities of park living meant that not all families could endure the conditions year-round. In a poignant letter dated September 24, 1923, then Yellowstone Superintendent Horace Albright expressed this dilemma to Assistant Director Arno B. Kammerer. Albright revealed the financial and emotional toll of relocating his family to California each winter to escape Yellowstone's cold. He candidly noted, "I have to do it or I could not stay in the game." The demands of life in the parks could either make or break a ranger's career, largely depending on the resilience of their family. And the spirit and resilience of the rangers' wives was as vast as the parks themselves. Despite the formidable challenges of park life, many women not only made these remote wildernesses their homes, whether year-round or seasonally, but also became integral to the park's operations and to the visitor experience. They brought with them not just a willingness to adapt and thrive in the most daunting of environments, but became the unsung heroines of the parks, offering tours, administering first aid, and on occasion providing meals to visitors out of their own kitchens. But their involvement went beyond hospitality and emergency care. Rangers' wives were pioneers in the development of educational and interpretive programs that today are fundamental to the national park experience. They developed museums, crafted interpretive materials, and engaged in natural history research, enriching the park's offerings and deepening the visitors' understanding of these treasured landscapes. Betty Jackson was not just a supportive spouse living in the shadow of her husband, Earl Jackson, superintendent of Montezuma Castle National Monument. She was a force of nature in her own right. She played a pivotal role in shaping interpretive plans, compiled extensive bird lists, initiated a bird banding program, and authored articles for the Southwestern National Monument's monthly reports. She's credited with significant archaeological discoveries at both Montezuma Castle and Bandelier National Monuments. Earl Jackson's January 1939 monthly report speaks volumes of her expertise and dedication, stating, "Give me another 5 years and I will know as much about our birds as my wife." Living in the parks was not for the faint of heart. The infrastructure was poor, and the amenities we take for granted today were luxuries or simply non-existent. Imagine calling a tent your home for years, not out of choice, but necessity. This was the reality for some park families, braving the elements day in and day out. For those who did have houses, safety and comfort were often compromised. Edgar and Gay Cook Rogers arrived at Bandelier National Monument in June of 1932. They were greeted by a house with a leaking roof and rooms filled with standing water. Edgar's sudden departure when his father died left Gay to manage these challenges alone. Yet she persevered, volunteering to lead tours and embodying the role of a ranger in her husband's absence. The isolation of these remote locations was compounded by unreliable supplies of water and electricity. When systems failed, repairs were not swift, forcing families to adapt to even harsher conditions. It's perhaps unsurprising that these strains led to a high rate of divorce among ranger families. In the face of adversity, park wives created a sense of community that transcended the challenges of their environment. They organized dinners, social events, even started newsletters to support each other. They established schools, libraries, and cultivated relationships with the surrounding communities. As World War II ushered in changes across the nation, the role of National Park Service wives began to evolve. The war years saw many stepping into roles vacated by men serving in the military. The post-war era brought about a shift in perceptions and roles, marking the end of an era, but also the beginning of new chapters for women within and beyond the National Park Service.
Ah, you hear that? The sound of a crackling fire. But this isn't just any old campfire. This is a smokeless solo stove fire pit. How can you tell? Well, you don't hear any coughing, hand wafting, or people complaining about smoke in their eyes. All you can hear are logs turning to coals as the night sky becomes a cosmic canvas. With Bonfire by Solo Stove, you get a fire pit that's portable, burns smoke off before it ever leaves the pit, and is backed by a lifetime warranty. Use promo code PARKS20OFF to get $20 off your next purchase of $200 or more at solostove.com. That's code PARKS20OFF.
In the early 1950s, the ethos of getting two for the price of one still prevailed within the National Park Service. Park wives continued to pour their hearts and souls into maintaining park communities, bolstering morale and contributing innumerable hours of unpaid work. However, as the decade progressed, these women began to leverage their collective experience and insight to address systemic issues within the Park Service, most notably the employee housing crisis. The 1952 National Park Conference at Glacier National Park became a pivotal moment for park wives. It was there that Herma Albertson Bagley, having lived in park housing since the late 1920s, took up the mantle to spearhead a movement that would forever change the landscape of national park housing. Under Bagley's leadership, the NPS Women's Organization conducted the first systematic survey of employee housing, revealing shocking deficiencies. A significant percentage of residences lacked basic amenities like running water, sewers, and electricity. The report catalyzed funding for the Mission 66 plan, aimed at improving facilities across the National Park Service. As the middle of the 20th century wore on, women were much more commonly entering the workforce. In the 50s, about 30% of women had jobs, and yet they weren't allowed to be park rangers. There were more paid jobs in parks for women, but rangers' wives were still thought of as free labor. And the tone and content of official National Park Service publications reflected the era's prevailing attitudes toward women, with columns that today would be seen as condescending and sexist. At the time of the Southwest Superintendents Conference in Tucson in February of 1967, women were still rarely allowed to be park rangers. This was 3 years after the Civil Rights Bill passed. At the conference, the idea of creating a booklet for park ranger wives was floated to help wives understand what's involved in being a Park Service wife. Women from several parks were tasked with the creation of the manual, and in late 1969, the completed booklet was sent to Washington for the Park Service to adopt and distribute it. The intro reads,
"Dear friend, welcome, new neighbor, to the National Park Service way of life. You are married to a very special man, or you would not be reading this letter. The Park Service challenges men who are intelligent, able to communicate and get along with people, and who also have a special love for our USA wonderlands. As the wife of such a man, you are also challenged. May your years be varied and happy ones as you live a long and fruitful career together. I write you because I, too, am a Park Service wife, and I understand some of the problems and questions you will be facing. To make things easier for you to adjust to the service, may I share the following?"
The book goes on to describe the benefits of moving from community to community as your husband is shuffled around the Park Service and the new friends there to welcome you.
"Most men choose the Park Service as a career because of a special interest or skill. They quickly become very involved in their work. If you don't want to be left out, share his interests. Read everything you can get your hands on that pertains to his field of work. Listen to him. Learn about the structure and organization of the NPS. Learn the various divisions and how they cooperate. It is easy to think of one's husband's line of work as being the most important. Learn the whole for a broader understanding of the full scope of what the NPS is trying to do. Just one word of caution. The job is his, not yours. Don't intrude into official duties."
The book goes on to describe the wonders of housing and how to keep one.
"The government has built new, closet-filled, well-planned, modern houses with stoves and refrigerators furnished. You will be assigned to one. In some of the older, smaller areas, housing may not be exactly what you would choose or what you had in mind. Some floor plans present the new housewife with a real challenge. Accept this challenge to your decorating and management skills to create the most attractive and pleasant surroundings for your family during your assignment in this area."
Keep in mind, these houses were not free, by the way. Rent was charged, and often they were in places that made homemaking quite a challenge.
"If you get sent to an isolated area, learn to make lists. As you run out of white thread or salt, write it down. Then when you make an infrequent trip to town, everything you need will be on that list. It is maddening to arrive home and suddenly remember something you forgot with town many miles away. If you aren't used to buying groceries in large quantities, roll up your sleeves and learn. This doesn't mean buying the giant size of everything, just buying more of each item at one time. One very nice thing about this kind of area is that whenever anyone goes into town, the word is spread and someone will gladly pick up a much-needed item or two for you. Just remember, when it is you going to town, to do these same favors in return. One more word of advice on Park Service living. Don't invest in more home furnishings than you need. Buy least expensive standard brand interior furnishings and appliances that can be easily serviced or replaced. For instance, unbleached muslin curtains can be made adjustable and will fit any decor. Keeping weight of furniture and other possessions down will help in the many moves."
I want to remind you here that this booklet is not from the early days of the Park Service. This was circulated in the 70s. And of course, the woman wasn't just expected to keep the household. She was expected to prepare her man for work.
Whatever your husband's position, how he looks on the job is important. The image he projects is the image the public associates with the National Park Service. This goes for everyone, regardless of the type of clothing worn. As a Park Service wife, it is your responsibility to see that his clothes are ready when needed, clean, and neatly pressed. He will appreciate this more than you'll ever know. If your husband wears a uniform, make proper use of the annual uniform allowance. Of course, this money is not to be spent on a night out or a new pair of shoes for you, but only to keep your husband's uniform up to date and complete. He may want to make do with what he has or get by with too little. Don't let him. A sloppy uniform is inexcusable, shows obvious carelessness, and impresses no one. It is not fair for wives to burden husbands with complaints about a neighbor when he has to work with the same man all day. Practice patience and understanding, and try not to let coffee chats degenerate into gossip sessions or comparisons of advancements in careers. If you feel your husband is especially able in his work, compliment him. Don't brag to your neighbor. When you move to a new park, you will enjoy making friends outside the park community in the area or town where you shop or send the children to school. Wives, sometimes more than husbands, color the community's impression of the NPS. There may be places where you will have to live down or make up for mistakes of wives who've gone before you. This isn't easily done. Be yourself, be honest, and try very hard to avoid self-centeredness.
That's just the introduction to the manual. It goes on at length about the history of the National Park Service that women were expected to learn, about saving for retirement, how to plan for a move, what to do if your husband dies. Today, women make up about 40% of the total National Park Service workforce. In this century, we've had two women serve as directors of the National Park Service and three as Secretary of the Interior. But there's still a long way to go. The strength, resilience, and profound impact of the women who stood behind and often alongside the official park rangers of America's national parks reflect a journey of unrecognized labor, evolving roles, and ultimately a push toward recognition and change within the National Park Service. The legacy of these remarkable women is not just in the museums they founded, the tours they led, or the educational programs they developed, but also in the shift toward inclusivity and recognition of all contributions within the National Park Service. Their story is a testament to the power of resilience, community, and the enduring spirit of the women who called the wilderness their home. This episode of America's National Parks was hosted by me, Jason Epperson, with narration by Abigail Trebue. If you enjoyed the show, please consider leaving us a rating and a review. If you're new here, make sure to subscribe to the podcast to get new episodes delivered to your feed. If you're looking for photos and tips about visiting national parks, check out our America's National Parks Facebook group. And if you're interested in RV travel, we hope you'll also check out our RV Miles podcast and YouTube channel. Today's show was sponsored by L.L. Bean. Follow the hashtag BeAnOutsider and visit llbean.com to find great gear for exploring the national parks. And by Solo Stove. Use promo code PARKS20OFF to get $20 off your next purchase of $200 or more at solostove.com.